Is an English-only driver's license test an affront to our community? Is the BSO no longer a popular police choice for Broward cities? And is Trump's TPS process racist? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we're going back to the future to discuss Florida's new English-only driver's license test, which in Miami is a historically sore subject and the subject of a new play that just opened here. We'll also examine what's feeling like a trend, cities in Broward County opting out of law enforcement contracts with the Broward Sheriff's Office. And we'll look at what's next after a federal judge blocked cancellation of Haitian TPS and where TPS stands after 35 years. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Starting today, Florida will be giving the state's driver's license tests in English only. Up to now, the test had been issued in several languages, including Spanish and Creole, which are widely spoken in Miami-Dade County and South Florida. But not anymore. The Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles insists English testing uniformity promotes safer driving. Critics call it just another anti-immigrant jab that could have the opposite effect by leaving non-English speakers without driver's licenses. Either way, it's an echo of 1980 when Miami-Dade County, then Dade County, passed an English-only ordinance amid a wave of Cuban and other Spanish-speaking immigration. That episode is the subject of a play now on stage in Miami Beach titled English Only. And there's this Sunday Super Bowl controversy, too. Spanish-singing superstar Bad Bunny is the halftime headliner. It all again raises the question, how do we strike the right balance in America between English, Spanish, and other languages? We'd, of course, like to hear your thoughts. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now for this discussion is Nicholas Griffin. He's the playwright who authored English Only, which is being presented by Miami New Drama at Miami Beach's Colony Theater through February 22nd. Also with us is Juan Pagan. He's president of the Florida Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in West Palm Beach. And we just want to update folks here with a clarification this morning from Miami-Dade County Tax Collector Dariel Fernandez that even though the new test rule goes into effect today, if you made an appointment for the test before today, you can still take it in whatever language you prefer, at least through March 31st. Juan Pagan, I want to start with you because this new Florida rule requiring driver's license tests in English is undoubtedly going to impact the Latino community that your chamber represents, and anything here that impacts the Latino community impacts the economy. So let me ask you up front, Juan, do you think this new English-only rule for Florida driver's licenses is a reasonable road safety measure, or is it an anti-immigrant stunt? And either way, what kind of effect do you see it having?
Well, good afternoon to everybody. It's a pleasure to be with you guys. One of the things we look at this is on a very type of, neutral, in the sense that has pros and has cons. And the things that could be, you know, the pros, well, people will have to know the language so they can know and avoid accidents and, you know, get involved in places that they don't have to be, and they can understand the language and telling them why they cannot drive through that road, why they should be not exceeding the speed limit, blah, blah, that kind of thing. But at the same time, when you look at a lot of the workers that work in our communities, you know, and I'm a resident of Palm Beach County for many years, over 35 years now, you know, and one of the things you see is that many of the people who work in the field, you know, picking those tomatoes, and either you and I will do it, you know, doing dishwashing at the restaurants, cleaning floors, etc. You know, how are they going to get to work if they do not understand that language that is being imposed, quote unquote, imposed on them?
Right. Now, I'm sorry, Juan, I just need to clarify the clarification that I mentioned earlier. The extension that the Miami-Dade County tax collector is referring to applies only to those who are taking the test in Spanish. I just wanted to make that clarification. So excuse me. Go ahead, Juan.
No, correct. So therefore, you have somebody who's been working here, and he's a legal resident, of the state, legal resident of the country, and he's been working, but he still doesn't know English, and that's reality, because that wasn't the main language. That was, he never had the opportunity to go to school, or whatever was the reason.
But what is the reality here, Juan? You and I were talking about this yesterday. For example, the case of the tragedy of the Sikh immigrant semi-truck driver last year who allegedly caused a crash in Florida that killed three people, and it turns out he did not know really how to read English highway signs. Is that the kind of reality the state is pointing to when it says we need to make sure people take these driver's license tests in English only?
Well, that's one of the points that obviously the state is trying to make. But at the same time, I think we should facilitate in a way that these drivers that never spoke English before, never took this test in English before, that they understand what is the rationale behind and what are the consequences if they made a mistake. But at the same time, that they understand what are the signs in the road, whether you're driving a turnpike, I-95, whatever might be that road that you're taking, that you understand the signs are going to be coming across, because those signs are not in Creole, they are not in Spanish, so they're not in Italian, they're not in French, so.
But some might argue, look, anybody, no matter what language they speak, when they see a red octagon, they know that that means stop. In
Correct.
any country, in any language, yeah. I
Yes.
want to listen here to a Cuban woman in Miami named Jessica Alarcón Delgado, who's been here only in the U.S. for a year and a half. She speaks little, if any, English, and she rushed to her local DMV this week to be able to take the driver's license test in Spanish before the English-only rule takes effect today.
Es muy difícil para nosotros los latinoamericanos poder.
It's very difficult for us Latin Americans to take a test in English when we don't even have a basic or intermediate level of English. It's very difficult for us because Spanish is our language. If I hadn't taken the test today, I would have had to start trying to take the one in English tomorrow.
Juan, what is the realistic mindset we should have here? Is it unrealistic for Florida, where people's lives depend on cars and where so many people's first language is Spanish, for example? Is it realistic to require them to take the driver's license test in English? Or is it unrealistic, if not unsafe, as Florida now insists, for people like Jessica there to think that English really isn't necessary in their daily life activities like driving?
In my opinion, the state should facilitate the understanding of that language, the understanding of what is done and why it's being done, but at the same time, that they understand what that sign is saying. What is the meaning of that sign? What is behind? That they should have a copy in their hands, in their house, whenever they finish driving.
Right.
Not to read it while they are driving. No, when they get to their place, that they can take a look step by step.
Right.
Not jumping into it right away, that then they first threaten, they first,
Right.
with fear. And at the same time, the impact that you have. We've been running this Chamber of Commerce, for over 20 some years already in Palm Beach County and the state of Florida. And one of the things we have seen, when we look at small businesses, you have about seven, between 7 and 10% of those small businesses that the owners do not speak a word of English.
Right. So
But
what
they are
you're.
the one, but they are the ones with the deep pocket that help that business move forward
Right.
and get employment and pay
So
taxes.
what you're sort of suggesting there is let them take this test in Spanish, but make sure that they know that stop on that red stop sign means alto, for example. Yeah.
Correct.
So as I mentioned at the outset, this takes us back 45 years ago to the English-only ordinance that Miami-Dade County, then known as Dade County, passed amid the backlash to the wave of Spanish-speaking immigration that the Mariel boat lift from Cuba brought in. And a Miami new drama play now at Miami Beach's Colony Theater, titled English Only, recreates that controversial upheaval in South Florida's history. The play was written by Nicholas Griffin. And Nicholas, I've got to say, your artistic timing was impeccable. What moved you to tackle this slice of Miami history for the stage?
Well, I think, there's certain themes that just seem to exist permanently inside the American culture, and immigration's obviously maybe the largest of them all. So, I didn't doubt that it would be relevant. I didn't think we'd be hitting the nail on the head and be opening on the same day that an English-only law passes in Florida, but there you go. I mean, I think there's a lot of comfort to be taken in that we've been down this path before. And I think it leads to the bigger question, which is, does politics affect culture or does culture affect politics? And I think if you look at what happened in the wake of 1980, it's sort of this pinball game between culture and politics. And the fact is that in 1980, 65% of Miami-Dade households spoke a first language at home that wasn't English.
Right.
And today, that number's 70%. It's only gotten more extreme. So that's who we are in this city. We're, you know, this is a city of pure immigration.
I want to listen to an excerpt from your play, English Only, here. It's the moment that really sparked that petition drive in 1980 to create the English Only ordinance for then Dade County, when a non-Latino woman named Emmy Schaefer complains to a local conservative radio shock jock about not being able to find anyone who speaks English.
All right, what do you want to talk about?
Well, you were talking about the boat lift and how it is changing Miami. And I know you're right, but I just want to say it is the little things. I was in the Westland Mall this morning. I was trying to buy a dress for my daughter. Everyone in front of me was Cuban. The sales girl was Cuban. And they were all talking together in Spanish, loudly.
Do Cubans speak any other way?
And I just didn't exist.
So as the dialogue there suggests, there was not a little bit of anti-Latino bigotry in the air at that time. But Nicholas Griffin, what are the parallels we should be drawing at this time between what we saw here in Miami 45 years ago and what we're seeing with Florida's new English-only driver's license rule today?
Yeah, well, I think you can hear even from that that the woman who leads the charge against immigration in 1980 is actually an immigrant herself. So I think that's something we've seen once again, that you see splits within the Latin American community politically between sort of pro and anti-Trump factions, not necessarily in the way that the rest of America was expecting. But if you live locally, you certainly can see it happening.
Yeah.
And I just think it is something that we go through again and again here. Every time there's deep worry about the amount of immigration happening either at a local or a national level, you get this extraordinary movements of resistance against it. And they take all sorts of forms, and language is among the most familiar.
We have a call from Gordon in Davie. Gordon, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on all of this?
Well, initially, I think it's a very childish position, and it simply adds to the fuel that Florida is maybe an undereducated state if they can't deal with other languages. Mm-hmm. I speak and write four languages. Not that I'm so smart or anything. I just learned them.
Yeah.
And it was difficult. I think this is crazy. I was here in the 70s and the 80s, and I lived around five different countries, and it was a huge English-only attitude that prevailed in the 80s. But it was amusing to come along the downtown Miami shopping area, walking on the sidewalks, but they were jammed with people.
Yeah.
There weren't any shopping malls.
Right.
And you would see on the on the door to a store, aquí nosotros hablemos inglés.
Right. So to make the point, yeah. No, that's an interesting perspective, a historical one, too. Thank you, Gordon. We appreciate it. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with playwright Nicholas Griffin, author of the new play English Only, and Florida Hispanic Chamber of Commerce President Juan Pagan about Florida's new English-only driver's license test and the age-old debate in South Florida and America about the tension between speaking English, Spanish, and other languages. Juan Pagan, I want to take a little broader look at the question of how English and Spanish and Creole and Portuguese and Arabic and other languages we often hear on our streets can and should coexist in this country, especially in this community. As I mentioned, there's been a lot of commotion in conservative circles because Puerto Rican reggaeton superstar Bad Bunny, who sings in Spanish, will be Sunday's Super Bowl halftime show. But the fact is, Juan, America has the world's second largest Spanish-speaking population behind Mexico. So what's the disconnect here?
Well, apparently it's like a refusal to understand and accept, you know. And like you and I talked before, you know, I was very fortunate that I worked for one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the country, the U.S., mm-hmm. you know, and they took me to different countries around the world. And I had the opportunity to learn a third language, you know, in there. Why? Because it was needed for me to understand that country. But in that country, the language that I brought in, you know, was English, well, was accepted, even though it was a foreign language for them
right.
in the country. Mm-hmm. But again, they accepted English. But at the same time, I learned their language, you know, and be able to communicate even better, understand better the country. So at the same time, you have these people who are working in the jobs that I mentioned already that none of us will able to do or would like to do it. But then those are the guys who are doing it in the field. Those are the guys who are doing it in the restaurant. Those are the guys who are doing it at the hotels and every other places. Mm-hmm. And when you look at those small businesses, they do pay taxes and they are legal residents. That's the reason when this Chamber of Commerce started, it started as the Puerto Rican Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. But then in 2020, we make that decision to do a DBA, doing business as the Florida Hispanic American Chamber of Commerce. Why? Because we have 22 countries that are legal residents in Florida and Palm Beach County.
Good point.
The whole thing is understanding this.
Yeah. Nicholas Griffin, you're originally from Great Britain, London. You came to the U.S. a little over a decade ago. So how do you think this language war here is reflected elsewhere in the world, like Europe and especially the U.K., your home country, where Brexit had a lot to do with resentment toward, quote, foreign influences, I remember. I mean, we're really not alone in this here, are we?
No. This certainly is an issue throughout Europe. I mean, I actually came here. I've only been in Florida 14 years. I actually came to America when I was 18 years old, and so 35 years ago. So I wasn't there for Brexit. So you can't blame all of that on me.
right.
But yeah, obviously, Britain has a slightly different set of issues. Mostly, I would say, because it is a welfare state. So mm-hmm. it really doesn't matter what language you speak when you land there. It's whether you're going to contribute quickly to the safety net that the entire country depends on. And
right.
I think that's the bigger issue in Britain, as opposed to here, where obviously health insurance comes normally with your employment.
Right. We have Larry on the line from North Miami. Larry, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective?
My perspective is very simple and straightforward. I've been here 57 years, born and raised in Miami Beach. I've seen a lot of things, people come and go. I've seen a lot of demands placed on others. I find this interestingly to be a uniquely problem that the poor and working people face, because rich people tend to be of all one homogeneous class or type. And I really think we just need to make room and cut out all the nonsense. Just because somebody doesn't speak the same language as you doesn't mean they aren't worth your time, energy, investment, or even consideration. Just be nice to people. It's not that hard.
Right. Okay. Well, Larry, thanks very much for that very good and humane advice. We're running out of time here, but I just want to mention again that Nicholas Griffin is the author of the play English Only, being presented through February 22nd by Miami New Drama at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach. And Juan Pagan is president of the Florida Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I really appreciate you both coming on to talk about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. And I'm looking forward to continue working together and helping our community. Because at the end, that's all we want to do. We want to help the community. We want to move forward and be positive while we're doing it. Thank you.
Nope. Thank you. Still to come, why more Broward cities are divorcing the Broward sheriff? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Last month, the city of Deerfield Beach in Broward County decided to end its relationship with the Broward Sheriff's Office, or BSO. In a rather emphatic 4-1 city commission vote, it opted to create its own police and fire rescue services, both of which the BSO had provided Deerfield Beach for the past 35 and 15 years, respectively. One big factor, a study showed Deerfield Beach that doing this could save the city $500 million over the next two decades. Now a similar study could prompt Pompano Beach to sever its own ties with the BSO, and Cooper City is considering it too, citing not just the rising costs, but also poor communication with Broward Sheriff Gregory Toney. Meanwhile, the Broward County Commission is questioning whether the BSO should continue as law enforcement for Port Everglades and Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. So why all this dissatisfaction with Florida's largest sheriff's office? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss what's starting to feel like a trend in Broward is Todd Drosky, the mayor of Deerfield Beach, and South Florida Sun Sentinel reporter Rafael Olmeda. Welcome to you both. Mayor Drosky, Deerfield Beach's law enforcement contract with the Broward Sheriff's Office expired in September, and that gives your city 2 years to either negotiate a new deal with the BSO or leave it. Deerfield Beach has chosen to leave it and create your own police and fire department. So can you walk us through why your city made that decision? I mentioned there the study by the Independent Center for Public Safety that showed you some pretty hefty taxpayer savings. Was that the only factor?
Well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Padgett, for having me on your show today. I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation and dialogue. But let me step back a little bit to tell you how we got to where we were.
Sure.
So in 2025, I was first elected mayor. We have March elections in Deerfield Beach. This issue was not even on the radar at that time. It was only a month later in April 2025 that this all started to come into play. And what happened is the city of Deerfield Beach had a contract for services with the Broward Sheriff's Office that had a 5% cap for costs on an annual basis.
Right.
So every year around April, because we have an October 1 fiscal year, so every year around April, early April, we receive a letter from the sheriff's office telling us what our number for the upcoming fiscal year is going to be. If it exceeded the 5% cap, we would send the sheriff's office a nice letter saying, please revise to the contract, and they would. If it was under the 5% cap, then we would sign. So it was really a harmonious relationship for year after year after year. There were no problems. Same thing this year happened. The sheriff sent us a letter asking for an annual increase of 11% in year one and 11% for year two.
Uh-huh.
And we said, please revise per the 5% contract. And instead of getting a revision, this year we received a letter terminating our contract with BSO effective October 1, 2025.
Okay.
So that started where the whole process.
Okay. Now, Rafael Olmeda, Broward County Sheriff Gregory Toney was apparently, and I guess unsurprisingly, not pleased with Deerfield Beach's decision, and he called that Center for Public Safety study flawed and biased. What's his argument against cities like Deerfield Beach pulling out of their BSO relationship?
Thanks again for having me. The argument that Sheriff Toney has put forward is that this study did not take all of the startup costs into effect and did not consider things such as union negotiations and contracts and different long-term costs that are going to affect Deerfield Beach as it moves forward, creating its own independent police force. Toney's argument was that their study was performed very quickly, as these studies go. They commissioned this study, I believe, in October, and gave their findings at the end of December. That's about 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of time for the scope of what they were studying. It doesn't mean that I'm questioning the outcome of the study.
Sure.
The sheriff was questioning the outcome of the study given
right.
that time frame. So that's part of what he's saying. The upshot of his argument is, you know, Deerfield, you're getting a very, very rosy prediction because you want a very rosy prediction. And reality mm-hmm. is going to be much worse than that.
So So Mayor Drosky, what's your response to Sheriff Toney's assessment there?
Well, the study was not rushed. Remember, we were put in this predicament because the sheriff terminated our contract, which kicked in a 2-year transition period. So we are on a 24-month calendar to get a resolution done. So we had to do the study in a quick period of time, but it wasn't rushed. Remember, the Center for Public Safety started in October and finished in December. They were basically working nonstop every day and night during that 3-month period just on our study. So what would have taken normally, you know, twice that amount of time with another city, they condensed by focusing solely on us during that period of time.
Right.
And the average savings was $450 million. On the conservative side, it would be $250 million. And on the other side, it would be $950 million. So almost $1 billion savings. So the average savings is half a billion.
But Mayor Drosky, from a purely law enforcement and public safety standpoint, though, putting those cost savings aside for a second, why does Deerfield Beach feel that moving to its own localized police and fire rescue agencies will be better for the 87,000 residents of your city?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. Thank you very much. And so I want to reinforce that the decision was not based solely on a financial decision. It was more based upon what the community was telling the elected officials, is that they wanted their police and fire services to be back under local control. We don't have any local control with the Broward Sheriff's Office with respect to staffing, with respect to overtime, with respect to costs. Those are all passed through to the city. So the city doesn't have any ability to negotiate those. And the sheriff doesn't have any incentive to negotiate them because it's a just pass through from his office to ours.
Right.
So the citizens and residents of our community wanted to bring back the fire and police services so they know who, by name, who their police and fire officers are that they're dealing with on a daily basis.
Okay. Rafael Olmeda, despite Sheriff Tony's objections, the reality is that we're seeing at least two other cities in Broward County, Pompano Beach and Cooper City, moving in the direction Deerfield Beach has taken. And as I mentioned, in Pompano Beach and Cooper City, the issues seem to include not just costs, but communication, which I think Mayor Drosky sort of hinted at there in the Deerfield Beach context. Why does the BSO seem to be losing its luster for these municipalities?
I don't know that it is, in fact, losing its luster. I want to be careful saying that.
Sure,
as a reporter.
Sure.
I have no objection to you saying it, but as a reporter, I'm just kind of, I want to take a little step back there.
I understand.
Those are questions that I would ask, and the answers that I've gotten in Pompano are that there's very much a concern, as Mayor Drosky pointed out, that there's a lack of connection between the law enforcement and the community. Particularly a few weeks ago, there was an incident involving somebody who was arrested in a manner that some are calling brutality or excessive force. They have been trying to arrange a meeting with the sheriff over the issue. They have not gotten that meeting. So this kind of communication is crucial to maintaining a positive and constructive relationship. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, and I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb here, Gregory Tony can be brash. He's unapologetic about that. He will go out there and he will say things that might, you know, raise your hackles if you're looking for a fight. And that's part of what happened at Deerfield Beach. And I think that when people observe his demeanor when he's communicating with other people, they think, you know, are we getting the respect from the sheriff that we want? Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not saying that.
No.
I can certainly see it. I can certainly observe it.
That's what I was asking, Rafael, is what you are hearing, from these municipalities.
It's not something that the sheriff is unaware of. I mean, the first thing he did with Deerfield was he said, listen, I'm gonna issue an apology. He doesn't actually apologize, but the way he said it was so close to an apology that you have to accept it as one. It's not style.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Deerfield Beach Mayor Todd Drosky and South Florida Sun Sentinel reporter Rafael Olmeda about what may be a move or a trend by Broward County cities away from ties with the Broward County Sheriff's Office. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mayor Drosky, I wanted to ask you the same question from a local government's perspective. I mean, here in Miami-Dade County, for example, towns like mine, Palmetto Bay, we use Miami-Dade County Sheriff's deputies to police our streets, and there's been little, if any, controversy. So do the cities in Broward, like yours, feel that there are some problems with the Broward County Sheriff's Office that they'd perhaps rather not have to deal with?
I don't know so much that it's problems. It's just that the BSO model doesn't fit Deerfield Beach anymore. The BSO model is fit for more smaller cities. For example, if you're having a deputy who's called out sick, the replacement is coming from Weston or for Hallandale Beach to Deerfield Beach. That deputy is going to do an excellent job while on call, but he doesn't know the streets. He doesn't know the residents. He's there to do a shift and then to go home. And that model doesn't fit large, mm-hmm. large cities anymore. Deerfield Beach is the 10th largest city in Broward County, the 13th largest city in the Miami metropolitan area. And of the 431 cities in the entire state, we're number 35. So we're not right. a small city anymore. Mm-hmm. And the model just doesn't fit small cities, that the especially ours that want the local control. Right. When it gets too big, you lose that local control, and that's not what the residents want.
Right. Finally, Rafael Olmeda, next week marks the 8th anniversary of the Parkland school shootings that cast the Broward County Sheriff's Office in such a negative light back then. That tragedy, of course, predates Sheriff Tony, but under his watch, the Parkland victims' families are saying they're still not seeing the accountability, the admission that its officers failed to adequately respond to save lives that day, that they feel the BSO should have owned up to by now. What's the situation there as you see it?
I'm going to tread very carefully on the subject.
As we should, of course, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm covering this. I need to be careful how I frame things. I will say this much. These families have been through a hell that nobody could imagine. And on top of not getting a quick resolution for their lawsuit against the sheriff's office, they have seen other court proceedings not really go their way. What they wanted out of the killer's death penalty trial right. Was an outcome that they did not get. Mm-hmm. What they wanted from the trial of a school resource officer, Scott Peterson, they did right. not get the outcome that they wanted. They're frustrated, they're hurt, and this is not the kind of wound that goes away very easily.
No.
At the same time, the sheriff's office can't go out and just say, okay, we screwed up. They right. need to defend themselves and mm-hmm. Present themselves in such a way that they really did try to do everything they could. Remember, right. Sheriff Tony is not sheriff if not for the failures of BSO.
Exactly.
So I do know that he understands
right.
the criticisms, but it's hard for an agency in this position to simply give up and say, okay, well, how much do you want?
No, those are good points. Rafael Olmeda is a reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Todd Drosky is mayor of Deerfield Beach. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you. Appreciate the
Thank
time.
Thank you.
Still to come, what's next for Haitian TPS holders and what's next for TPS? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. This week, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. blocked, for now, the Trump administration's plan this week to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for more than 350,000 Haitians in the U.S., more than 100,000 of them here in South Florida. TPS shields migrants from deportation back to countries torn by natural disaster or political violence, and the federal judge, Ana Reyes, said the way the administration is ending it for Haitians violated the TPS statute and likely involved racial discrimination. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem denies the racism charge and will likely appeal Reyes's ruling. So, what are the chances it could be reversed? And if it is, do hundreds of thousands of Haitians then face deportation back to Haiti, a country all but ruled by violent gangs? But even if Reyes's ruling sticks, what about the administration's argument that TPS, which was created by Congress 35 years ago, has lost its temporary refuge purpose and has morphed into a permanent immigration avenue? Let us know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from Chicago is Jeff Pipoli, one of the attorneys representing Haitian TPS holders in the case Judge Reyes ruled on this week. And joining me from Biloxi, Mississippi is Chris Chmielewski, president of the Washington-based nonprofit Immigration Accountability Project. Jeff Papoli, I want to start with you because the big TPS news this week was, in fact, that U.S. District Court Judge Anna Reyes did rule in your favor by halting the Trump administration's cancellation of TPS for Haitians. Here was the response of Haitian TPS holder Farah Larrioux, who heads the Miramar Haitian American Residents and Business Owners Association here in South Florida.
And I start screaming, screaming. I start also crying because it was a big relief. And I start now collecting more information about what it means, what is the next step.
So, Jeff, she mentions, what does this ruling mean? I think the first thing we need to mention, obviously, is that Judge Reyes did not say that the Trump administration is wrong to end temporary protected status for Haitians, or that it was even wrong to claim that Haiti is somehow safe to deport hundreds of thousands of Haitian migrants back to. What was it exactly that Judge Reyes did say in this ruling that gave her reason to block the administration, at least as she wrote, pending further review?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me. Judge Reyes ruled essentially that the process that Congress established in order to evaluate TPS designations to decide whether they should be extended, redesignated, or terminated was fundamentally flawed. And I push back a little bit on the idea about the role that country conditions and that analysis played in this ruling. It's sort of a fine distinction, admittedly, but the evidence of country conditions that was in the record was relevant to her ruling.
Right, right, in the sense that the process did not take it under sufficient consideration.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And so Judge Reyes ruled essentially that there was enough evidence in this record to suggest that the secretary's stated reasons for terminating TPS, namely that Haiti is safe and that it's contrary to the national interest to continue Haitian TPS, that those reasons were not her real reasons.
Right. And as you said, and therefore the process under the TPS statute, or that should have been followed under the TPS statute then, was flawed, if not unlawful.
That's right. I mean, one very clear example of this is the State Department consultation component. Now, this is my third TPS case. I did one during 2018 and 2019, one last summer, and now this case. And right. I can tell you that typically, and this is actually required by the law, that for the secretary to consult with appropriate agencies of government. Well, the appropriate agency of government most on point and most relevant for their input would be the State Department. And in previous administrations, the State Department would submit long, lengthy reports. It would give, you'd get input from the ambassadors and from the embassy on the ground. In this case, there was a single two-sentence email that essentially said, hey, does State Department have any problem with us terminating? And the answer was no.
Right. And Homeland Security essentially said, it's just not in the national interest for us to let TPS go on for Haitians.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
It's the departure from these extensive country conditions reports and analyses that we would have in the past that all got reduced to a two-sentence email. Right. It was really shocking to see.
And Jeff, I think the remark Judge Reyes made in a ruling that stood out to most people was that the Trump administration's decision to end TPS for Haitians, and not just for Haitians, but a host of other migrant groups, likely involved racial discrimination. How did she come to that rather blunt conclusion?
Yeah, it's quite a remarkable component of the ruling. She got there, I would say, in two ways. The first way was by observing that the administration has terminated every single TPS designation that has come up for review since January of 2025. All of those countries are predominantly non-white. Meanwhile, the only refugee immigrants that we are currently taking are white South Africans. So on the one hand, you've got the administration trying to terminate lawful status for refugees that are non-white, and you've got the administration explicitly privileging white immigrants from South Africa.
Right.
The other way she got there was simply by relying on the president's and Secretary Noem's statements. Famously, when the president said they're eating dogs and cats, those were about Haitians in particular.
Yeah.
And he's also said things like Haitians all have AIDS, and of course the famous statement that contains a swear word that I don't think I can say on the radio.
Chris Chmielewski, I know the Trump administration denies the charge that its TPS decision process is in any way racist. Setting that particular dispute aside, can you walk us through the administration's decision to cancel TPS for Haitians and Venezuelans and other groups for that matter, as you see it from your perspective?
Well, I think they view it as a flawed program. As you mentioned, this was originated in the Immigration Act of 1990, so it's been around for a while. But there have been very few countries who have received TPS designation, and I would emphasize that TPS stands for temporary protected status, that have actually lost their TPS status. Mm-hmm. It's become very difficult, mostly through these court challenges, to actually allow one of these given statuses to just expire, run out, or you know, to announce that they're not going to renew it at the end of its term. Mm-hmm. So it's lost that emphasis of just being a temporary protected status. Now, going back into the rationale, I think they just look at it again as a flawed program. This is something that, okay, you want to view the current administration's view of issuing or revoking TPS or terminating the TPS program for certain countries was arbitrary. They would also argue that the giving of TPS status for some of these countries was also arbitrary. But there is a process that's put in place, and I'm confident that they will continue to appeal the judge's decision. And if they don't end up being successful in the case, they'll try again and they'll go through the steps that are outlined by the judge.
Well, Chris, along those lines, we know that the Trump administration is, I think, already moving to appeal Judge Ray's decision, perhaps straight to the Supreme Court for emergency relief. And one of its chief arguments is that federal courts like Washington's simply have no jurisdiction in TPS cases like this. Can you help us explain that argument and how likely it is to sway the appellate judges moving forward?
Yeah, well, I'll first state that I'm not an attorney.
Neither am I.
I'm at a disadvantage for that. But the statute does say that there is no judicial review of any determination by the Attorney General with respect to the designation or termination or extension of a designation of a foreign state under this subsection. Now, it does also say that they have to come up with administrative procedures for review of denial of benefits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it does lay out a process. They have used the rulemaking process to create ways to not only grant TPS to some countries and also to terminate TPS to other countries. So, you know, it's all up for debate. I mean, my position is that Congress has ultimate power, authority over immigration authority. Let's give this TPS designation authority back to Congress where it belongs.
And I should mention there is a discharge resolution on the floor of the House right now to force a vote on whether Haitian TPS should be extended for another 3 years. We'll see how that works out. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Chicago attorney Jeff Pipoli and Chris Chmielewski of the Immigration Accountability Project about this week's Haitian TPS ruling and where the temporary protected status program stands 35 years after Congress created it. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jeff Pipoli, the other question our TPS holder here, Farrell Ariu, asked earlier was, what's the next step? What I've been hearing from Haitians all week since Judge Reyes' Monday night ruling is that it's too early to celebrate, that they'll breathe easy again when they see, for example, their TPS work papers renewed. But I think, as you mentioned, under this ruling, their work authorization is still retained for now. Either way, what are the next steps in this case that Haitian TPS holders should be most aware of?
Well, I think, first of all, yes, their work authorizations remain valid, and I would encourage any employers to go to the USCIS landing page for Haiti TPS. The government updated that website to confirm that their work authorization papers remain valid. The next step in this case, in fact, the government appealed, filed a notice of appeal last night. That was expected. This will go first to the DC Circuit, and we'll see what happens at that point. If I could push back on one of the things I just heard a moment ago, and it's something that I hear quite a bit.
Just quickly.
Well, Congress did intend TPS to be temporary, and we don't say otherwise. It's just that, as Judge Reyes wrote in her ruling, and I'm quoting here, if Congress meant the period to be short, it would have said so. When a lot of people say they mean temporary, that mean what temporary under the statute means until it is safe to send people back. For some countries, that might be 6 months to a year. For some countries, that might be 2 or 3 years. For in Haiti's case, given all the challenges and all the death and destruction that's in Haiti right now, it's simply not safe to send people back. So the facts don't support it. It's still temporary, despite the fact that it's gone on for longer than some people might prefer.
Right. Well, you've just given the response to to the question, the answer to the question that I was just going to ask Chris Chmielewski now. So, Chris, let me ask you, what's the next step for TPS? What's the future of this temporary protected status program that Congress created 35 years ago, but has become one of the most scrutinized, if not criticized, U.S. immigration devices? Now, a few years ago, Chris, you wrote an interesting article about what you called the contradictory use of TPS, and you quoted conservative economist Milton Friedman, who once said, quote, "Nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program." Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem suggested when she was here in Miami last weekend that President Trump is simply trying to restore the original temporary intent of TPS, right?
Right. I think they're just trying to bring integrity back to the program. And that's, again, going back to I don't disagree with what the other guest said regarding how Congress wrote this. I guess again, my biggest issue with it is, well, partly that it is temporary protected status, but very rarely has it actually been temporary. Most of the cases we've seen where it's been given, it's still in place today. But also that, again, in my view, this is a power that should be given to, or that Congress should have kept, and they just gave it off to the executive branch. And part of the reason why it was given to Congress is because Congress has a little bit more stability over the years, where an administration at the executive branch, it can bounce back and forth between different parties and different political persuasions every 4 to 8 years. So it's hard to take the politics out of temporary protected status, but I don't necessarily believe that this should be a program that should be politicized.
Right.
It should truly be Congress evaluating a situation. Okay, we've got a number of individuals from a particular country currently in the United States, and it's not safe for them to return, even though they do need to return. So let's give them some temporary protected status so they don't have to go back until
Right.
whatever issue happens to be happening in their country
Yeah.
is heading back. And I would just emphasize that. I think the biggest issue here is that it's just been given arbitrarily to the executive branch, who has politicized it.
Right. Just in the minute we have left, very quickly, I want to ask you both. Congress right now is at an impasse over Homeland Security and especially ICE funding as we move forward. Where should the middle ground be between abolishing ICE and letting ICE's abuses continue in your mind right now? Jeff Popoli, what's your view on that?
I'm this is not a dodge. I've genuinely been so busy with this case. It's been going at such a rapid fire rate. I haven't
Okay.
gotten into the details of the bill, but I will tell you, I was in Springfield, Ohio earlier this week, where the Haitian community is sticks out like a sore thumb in a
Yeah.
small white Midwestern town, and they are terrified of ICE coming.
No, I know. And Chris, just in 20 seconds, your response to that?
Yeah, I don't. I think they're going to find some sort of middle ground, not entirely where that falls, but both sides will be able to claim a win at the end. But I think at the end of the day, ICE will not be abolished. It will continue as an institution.
Okay.
Their tactics may just be less aggressive moving forward.
Okay. Chris Chmielewski is president of the Immigration Accountability Project. Chicago attorney Jeff Popoli represents Haitian TPS holders. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally, on the roundup, reggaeton superstar Bad Bunny will be the Super Bowl halftime headliner on Sunday. This has already been a big and historic week for the Puerto Rican recording artist, also known as Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio. His album, Debí Tirar Más Fotos, won Album of the Year at the Grammys, the first time an all-Spanish language album has received that top prize. Yes, Bad Bunny's Super Bowl billing has irked some people because he sings in Spanish and he's been critical of ICE and President Trump's immigration policies, which is the reason he's not been touring on the U.S. mainland these days. But he's still one of the most streamed singers in the world. And as he says, you don't have to speak Spanish to enjoy the show. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.